Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, your guide to what's good in pop culture. Every week, Jesse Thorne interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. We like Bullseye. Find Bullseye now at iTunes under Podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll be taking a look at a couple of television shows, one that's been around for a while and is about to take its final bow, and another that's been around for a much shorter time but is already making a big splash. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And from out on the West Coast, we are always extraordinarily happy to be joined by our friend Barry Hardiman. Barry, what do you do at NPR when you're not talking to us?
I'm an editor at NPR's Weekend Edition.
And I have to say, I recently heard Barry talking up steamy books on All Things Considered with Rachel Martin, and that was pretty great, I thought.
It's kind of becoming a thing, just smut.
Yeah, it's great.
Smut correspondent.
I was just going to say, you can be our smut correspondent.
Barry Hardiman, smut correspondent. From the smut correspondent to the Midwest, which is always a natural transition. The first thing we're going to talk about this week is parks and recreation. Now, as many of you know, by the time you hear this show, it will have had its final episode. And it's going out after 7 seasons.
Yeah.
And We did want to take a little time to talk about this show. It premiered before we were all gathering together to do this. So I don't think we've ever really talked a whole lot about it, except for the million times we've talked offhandedly
glancingly
about how much we like it.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a little time for it this week. First of all, I want to get an update from Stephen. Now, Stephen, you started mainlining this show not terribly long ago.
Yeah, a few years ago, I actually sat down with my pal Linda Holmes, perhaps you've heard of her, and watched like 5 episodes of it. And I filed it away as something that I enjoy and something that I would enjoy mainlining at some later point.
Those episodes from the first season?
Linda was very careful. She started with episode 6.
Ah, smart.
Oh, that is really
smart.
So,
rock show.
She knows what she's doing.
Yeah,
that,
so
Linda.
She starts with Never in the Past.
Started
and
with rock show.
It worked our way a few episodes into the second season.
Okay, good.
Oh,
and so I had a nice taste of the show, enough to know that this thing, I have Netflix. I am somebody who buys TV on DVD for cheap. I started squirreling it away for when I, I'm laid up sick or have a weekend to just do nothing. And finally, I started mainlining it within the last couple weeks. And I started mainlining it with the kids. So I'm all over the place. I've solidly watched the first 4 seasons, and then I pick up smatterings here and there because the kids are less mobile than I am and have fewer responsibilities. And so I'm occasionally picking up plot points like, whoa, this happened. I haven't seen every single episode. I've seen most of the first 6 seasons.
Okay.
You're a longtime viewer, Glenn.
Yes, from the beginning.
Yeah.
Seen every episode.
How about you, Barry?
I'm a longtime viewer, although I think I consumed the first 4 seasons in one go and then became a viewer.
Well, what do you like about it, Barry?
I like something that Stephen just said, which is that you can, I mean this as a real compliment and it's going to sound annoying, but like you could, this is one of the few shows on television that is smart and edgy and wonderful that you could still watch with your kids.
Yeah.
It's got this soul of just sort of fizzy optimism. There are not a lot of sitcoms now. That can preserve a kind of snappy writing that isn't too treacly. It makes me feel like I want to be a better person. And yet it doesn't make me feel like I need to be ashamed of myself for laughing at things that are more in the black humor category. And I, of course, think Amy Poehler is particularly good. She's just like a little sunshine.
Yeah.
I know. What I'm really curious about is what Glenn loves about this, because this is like the sunshiniest. It's like getting a hug, because I don't know how to describe the acid that it brings, because it's great acid.
Well, it's around the outside. Alan Sepinwall had a great piece on HitFix earlier this week that basically said that the show, once the show discovered what to do with Amy Poehler's character, the show kind of found itself. In the first season, and everybody says this, in the first season, which was not, it was like only those five beginning episodes, it was still patterned very closely on The Office. And Amy Poehler's character, Leslie Knope, was delusional optimist in the way that Michael Scott on The Office is self-involved and self-deluded about his worth. They changed her in the second season to being an optimist who is very good at her job. And that is a hugely important difference to make. All of a sudden, the relationships which were toward her, all the people in the office around her were looking at her with disdain, now were treating her differently because they could appreciate that despite her intensity and despite her sort of bulldozer approach, she gets things done and she's very good at it. The whole town that surrounds the show, the town of Pawnee, is filled with, if you look at them, really mean, petty, venal people who are not villains, but they are comic foils.
Yeah.
Consistently,
that's right.
They're antagonists who you don't hate, you laugh at.
Joan, who's the...
Joan is a perfect example.
Yeah, Joan Calamezzo, who's the...
the host of
Pawnee Today or whatever it is.
So that dynamic of somebody frustrating Amy Poehler's character and then Amy Poehler just bulldozing past him because she doesn't care, that's the core of the show. I also think, in a very real way, about the character played by Adam Scott, Ben Wyatt, finding a home. Finding a community. Mm-hmm. Mark, who was the romantic interest for both Leslie and Anne in the first two seasons, brought a cynicism that the show doesn't need because he was a city planner who was very jaded and been beaten down by the job. But that cynical pragmatism, on paper, it works great with Leslie Knope's character, but the chemistry wasn't there. And you also had Ron, her boss, providing a sort of cynical pragmatism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What they did when they brought in Adam Scott is they brought in a character who is an outsider who is trying to understand what she sees in this town, and we, the audience, are in his shoes. So as soon as he clicked into place, I think the show really found itself.
Yeah.
So it takes a while, but I think that's what I love about it.
Well, and at the same time, they bring in Ben Wyatt. They also bring in Rob Lowe.
Sure.
Chris Traeger.
Chris Traeger, the great Rob Lowe.
And they managed to find a way to use Rob Lowe, who has this... a different kind of oppressive sunniness.
Yes, it's a wonderful foil to hers.
And I love the fact that in the way that he is brought in at first to be this kind of Superman, this kind of perfect human Rob Lowe, like Rob Lowe is currently playing in a line of TV commercials. Mm. They undercut that by also making him in many ways a terrible boss.
Yeah.
And that he is the terrible boss of the variety who can't bear to give anybody bad news.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
he offloads all of the bad news onto Ben Wyatt. I love, they do a nice job of giving everybody multiple sides. And even the meanness that is exhibited in the show, the negativity that is generated toward, for example, Jerry, who's the office pariah, and many offices have a pariah, so I'm glad they figured that out and made there be an office pariah. Even that is offset by a certain gentility and a certain tendency when the chips are down and Leslie is faced with whether to lay off Jerry. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, Jerry is the most vital part of the office and the most important person on earth.
Right.
And there would be a revolt if we got rid of Jerry. So there's kindness just under the surface of the negativity, which is largely just played for silliness.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think one of the things I really appreciate about the other people who work in that office is that they're not types. They sort of began as types, or they have a seed that's a type in the way that Aubrey Plaza plays April Ludgate, the kind of sulky intern, but then becomes this really fascinating, funny, you know, deeply feeling young woman who gets this crush on this big goofball that Chris Pratt is playing. But if you look at somebody like Donna, the character who's played by the actress Retta, she is such a complicated, interesting, funny character. She's a libertarian like Ron is in some ways. She has some of those same kind of, I don't entirely trust the government kind
of
things.
Materialistic
in a more materialistic way.
Yeah.
She loves her Mercedes. Mm-hmm.
She doesn't just want a steak.
You get the feeling she has an incredibly active sex life and is always off doing some majestic, weird thing that she's barely telling you about. Mm-hmm. And she kind of drops that, like, what her cousin is genuine. That is such an interesting, rich character who on a lot of shows would just be a type, right? Would be either a kind of mouthy Greek chorus-y person. They wouldn't mm-hmm. bother to fill out such a really rich person. And one of the things that I like about the show, too, Glenn mentioned how they changed Leslie Knope from that first set of six episodes into the second season. When Mike Schur, who is one of the showrunners who also worked on The Office and works on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, has talked about that, one of the things that he has said is that he believed that they kept Leslie mostly the same, and what they changed was the way other people reacted to her. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is a good example of how, in a lot of ways, the animating principle of the show is that people are defined by the connections that they have with other people. It's right. It's an incredibly warm show, and I mm-hmm. think that one of the things I like about it is, you know, we went through this long period of sitcoms where everything on sitcoms was hugging and learning, right? And then mm-hmm. as when Seinfeld came along, they had that motto that people quoted, no hugging, no learning. And I think it was very healthy to explore the idea that a sitcom could be great and funny and worth watching even if there was no hugging and no learning. But then we sort of moved into this era where it felt like if you had any hugging or if you had any learning, you were automatically a dumb kind of low rent show. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like about Parks and Rec, and I was saying this to somebody today, is that it is equally suspicious of maudlin sentimentality and ironic detachment, mm-hmm. right? It is equally suspicious of people who go through life throwing flowers at everything and not meaning anything that they say, and people who kind of look at everything and just, it has a distrust of cynicism that I appreciate.
Well, this is my whole thing with this show, is this show is an examination of friendship from so mm-hmm. many different angles. This show is very interested in friendships among women. I mean, there are a lot of platonic male-female friendships in this show that, wow, it's not a big deal at all. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that is something that is very near and dear to my heart.
Yeah.
This show does such a wonderful job setting you up to root for positive outcomes for these people,
mm-hmm,
which it then tends to pay off in the form of these tiny little smiles.
Yeah.
And they just gut me every time. I just sit there. I realize a lot of the time as I'm watching the show that I'm just sitting there waiting for good things to happen to people. Mm. And it's very rewarding in that way. You mentioned April Ludgate, and April Ludgate is my favorite character on the show. In part, she's a cross between a former coworker of mine. One of her jobs was to be unimpressed by people. She worked at The Onion, and she was perfect. And she's a cross between her and my daughter.
I knew you were going to say that, and I was so excited to hear it.
I feel such an intense bond with that character for that reason. It's a cross between one of my best friends and my daughter. What more can you say? And the evolution of that character and the fact that that character over time becomes a very different person, even while retaining the core qualities that make her funny and cutting through the treacle of the show. And so you see that character become a very different person by the end of the series in a way that to me is not implausible at all for somebody that age.
But on the surface, she doesn't change. It's just that we have grown to know her so well that we know what's going on behind everything that she's saying. That's an important thing. Characters shouldn't become different. They should grow. Just as people grow. Let's talk about the writing, though. When you have a skilled cast as this, with, you know, a lot of improvisers in it, and you have some great writers, you can do this thing that this show excels at, which are these quick runs, these quick montages of multiple takes.
Good. Zerts are what I call desserts. Tray trays are entrees. I call sandwiches Sammy's, Sandoozles, or Adam Sandler's. Air conditioners are cool blasters with a Z. I don't know where that came from. I call cakes big old cookies. I call noodles long ass rice. Fried chicken is fry fry chicky chick. Chicken parm is chicky chicky parm parm. Chicken cacciatore, chicky catch. I call eggs pre-birds or future birds. Root beer is super water. Tortillas are bean blankies. And I call forks food rakes.
You mentioned Alan Sepinwall, and Alan's been doing some interviews with the cast and some of the writers wrapping up this show. And in his interview with Mike Schur, they talked about specifically about that bit with Tom Haverford, played by Aziz Ansari, who I think is so good on this show and found his ideal part. And I'm
it's a niche, but it's he's in it.
He talked about that bit where Tom was rattling off the names of foods, which was, I think, a combination of they wrote it and then also they just kind of let it go. He was talking about the short limitations on episode length. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about those trade-offs. And he said that was one of those things where there was no reason for that to be in the show except that it was everyone's favorite thing.
Yeah.
And I think that is a show that has been really smart about saying, yes, you have to kill your darlings. Yes, you have to be willing to give things up to meet the length. And everybody knows those decisions are painful. Mm-hmm. But you have to have that feel for, like, you know what? That's everybody's favorite thing. Yeah. We're leaving it in. Mm-hmm. And you can find the stuff in the show very often that I think comes from that impulse.
Can I put in a plug for my favorite montage, which is the why Leslie shot Ron moment in maybe the second season, where she gives what is just this amazing blitz of, like, sarcastic excuses for shooting Ron, which she did not do.
I let my emotions get the best of me. I cared too much, I guess. I was thinking with my lady parts. I was walking and I felt something icky. I thought there was gonna be chocolate. I don't even remember. I'm wearing a new bra and it closes in the front, so it popped open and it threw me off. All I wanna do is have babies. Are you single? I'm just like going through a thing right now. I guess when my life's incomplete, I wanna shoot someone. This would not happen if I had a penis. What? Bitches be crazy. I'm good at tolerating pain. I'm bad at math. And I'm stupid.
It's one of the great pieces of feminism on television, but it's also just a great example of those montage moments that I would say I watch like 7 or 8 times a year when I'm feeling down.
Yeah. There's one with Chris Pratt doing band names too. It's in that episode Rock Show that I started with.
Which is it's episode 6 of the first season. It's a fine place to start the show. Oh my God, the attention to detail with the sound of his band and the attention to detail with the sound of his singing voice. And very early on, he's like, we're really hard to define. Like, we're like a little bit like the Fray and like Matchbox 20. Oh my God, they just get everything about it is right. I just want to mention Purd Hapley.
For a female perspective on this scandal, we turn to a woman. Leslie, no, I'm about to ask you a question right now. And that question is this. The lewd photo, just how big a deal is it?
Well, frankly, Purd, it's not that big a deal, if you know what I mean.
I don't know what you mean, but it had the cadence of a joke.
Yeah,
because Purd Hapley is another way that this show is allowed to breathe a little bit. Purd Hapley is a tertiary presence on the show, and he's a speck of cilantro that seasons an episode just right. But just
he's their local news guy,
and who hosts the segments You Heard with Purd.
So good.
I just want to mention that I love Purd Hapley. That's really all I have to add.
I think in that same interview, I think Cher was talking about how one of his favorite cut Purd bits was a shot of Purd just looking at a bowl of nuts and saying, the thing about these nuts is they're mixed. Weird newscaster.
Of just the insight thing. Allergic so newscaster. Good. Oh, I love Purd.
And we have not talked a whole lot yet about Chris Pratt, because I have talked about Chris Pratt so much in the past. I do think that performance and the kind of creation of this enormously likable person out of this guy.
Enormous person.
Who started off as like a terrible boyfriend example. Then they kept finding other jobs for him to do, one of which resulted in the time that he was sitting in the office when Leslie had the flu. It's one of my favorite things that ever happened on this show when... now we're just Chris Farley showing this. I don't know, but when Leslie came out of her office with the flu.
Leslie, I typed your symptoms into the thing up here and it says you could have network connectivity problems.
Oh my gosh, I love that show.
I have to say, by the way, the fact that none of us have gone on at length about Ron Swanson, I think, is interesting and actually speaks to, because he's like, I feel like the one that they thought was going to be, I don't know, the Kramer or something, you know, like the thing who popped out of it. But right, exactly.
And
but
I think
he has been to a point, but I think it's interesting that when you talk to people about this show, he pops up every 6 people because the whole cast is so good.
It tells you how many weapons they have.
Exactly. They have a full quiver. And I mean, it's rare to find a show like that.
Yeah.
Ron is an interesting counterpoint to how much this show loves good government.
Yeah.
And how much this show is in some ways about good government. Like, yeah, Leslie Knope is great at her job. She is in many ways like an idealized version of a public servant. Mm-hmm. You have this deep friendship between she and Ron, who wants to abolish the government and like reduce it mm-hmm. down to where there's one man at a desk who's in charge.
Hey, yeah. Of saying no to things.
Of saying
mostly.
No to things.
Mostly. Glenn, is there anything you're hoping for from the finale of this show as you go into it? And we will know by the time people hear this.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing a little whistle-stop farewell tour. We're seeing a lot of characters we haven't seen in a long time kind of come back. And
I was so happy they brought back Tom's girlfriend, Lucy.
Right, yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. I trust it not to be too sappy, but just be funny.
A show with this much hugging that Glenn likes this much.
Yeah. I know.
That's how you know that's how you know. That's how you know they hit
I can
the
recommend this now to literally everybody.
Yeah, I do true. Think my favorite character on the show is Ben. I think mm-hmm. just the fact that he's not just a straight man, they've also made him an unbelievable mm-hmm. nerd. Mm-hmm. And given the actor Adam Scott something to do instead of just sit there and react.
He's so great.
He is very funny as this incredible nerd with the cones of Dunsher.
Mm. Yeah, the game he invented.
They let just about everybody on this show be weird.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's true. Well, before we get off the topic of Parks and Rec and how much we love it, I did want to mention Glenn had a piece on the blog that ran last week that was following the death of Harris Whittles, who was one of the executive producers of Parks and Rec and wrote a bunch of episodes and acted on the show. Glenn, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, he was very, very funny, and it's very, very sad. He played on the show. He's one of these quadruciary characters,
sure
actually. He played an animal control guy named Harris. He was just great. He appeared on Comedy Bang Bang, another podcast, very often. And whenever he would do this thing called Harris's Foam Corner, where he would deliver jokes that he had written to himself that he knew were not good enough for his Twitter feed.
Yeah.
This week's episode of Comedy Bang Bang has Adam Scott and Chelsea Peretti and Harris Whittles, actually. And the episode itself is okay, but in the last 6 minutes of that episode, they've put together a lot of his best stuff from the Phone Corner, a lot of his best, and when I say best, I mean performatively bad jokes. And it's just, it was such a great thing to hear, because it's just pure laughter, and it's very sad.
Yeah, it was very, very sad news, and obviously it's one of those things where you kind of want to keep it separate from the, you know, you want to have the show wrap up the show, but you also want to make sure everybody takes a moment and remembers this particular guy. And I do recommend checking out Glenn's essay, which was a really, really fine and good piece of writing. So again, by the time you hear this, you're going to have seen the finale. We're going to have seen the finale, and we'll know exactly how everything wrapped up. Probably not with the Little House on the Prairie thing where they blow up all the town buildings.
It's not going to be a Barney Miller.
Yeah, it's not going to be a Barney Miller ending. I'm guessing it's going to be a little more upbeat, at least I am hoping so. So that is our show exiting the landscape this week. Our show that is new to the landscape that we want to talk about is Better Call Saul. Now, we have talked about Breaking Bad on this show before. Better Call Saul is the prequel to Breaking Bad, also from Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould. And it centers around Bob Odenkirk's character, who on Breaking Bad was named Saul Goodman, who on this show is named Jimmy McGill, which apparently was his previous name prior to whatever caused him to change it. When you looked at Saul on Breaking Bad, the issue a lot of the time was, how did this seemingly kind of dopey dude get into this unbelievably dark world that he was involved in as a lawyer for very, very bad people? Now, to quickly recap, Barry, you watched Breaking Bad, right?
I sure did.
And Glenn watched it, and I watched it. Steven, you've seen some, right?
I've only seen little bits and pieces of it. Ooh.
So you're coming in a little bit fresher, but you are a Bob Odenkirk guy.
I'm a big Bob Odenkirk guy. And went into it very curious about what they're going to do with Bob Odenkirk as mm-hmm. a lead dramatic actor, probably mm-hmm. in the way people wondered about how you make Bryan Cranston, who was known, I think, primarily as a comedic presence, you know, from Malcolm in the Middle.
I mean, this show has less of a really, really dark underbelly so far in the first three episodes mm-hmm. than Breaking Bad had.
I generally find that as a comedic actor, he makes me laugh and laugh and laugh. And as a dramatic actor, the beats don't always always feel quite right. He has a small role in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. I didn't find that to be a particularly seamless performance. He always to me seems like and part of that's my own biases. I'm just used to seeing him in a certain way. And full disclosure, I used to kind of know him. Mm-hmm. I interviewed him a million times in the AV Club and knew him as Onion adjacent for years. And so it's interesting the way they use his built-in humor chops as a way of building a world of desperation mm-hmm. around somebody who's kind of fundamentally a goofball. And how does this mm-hmm. fundamentally not very serious person handle very serious situations?
Yeah.
The nature of the show as basically an extended flashback is interesting because if you've watched Breaking Bad, there's connections that immediately mm-hmm. bubble up. Mm-hmm. You see this character. Oh, this character will later become X, Y, and Z. But there's also repeated references to times even before the show mm-hmm. is set. So there's mysteries about how that happened, how we got from that guy to this. I was really worried about this show because I think that the character of Saul Goodman, to say nothing of Bob Odenkirk, but just the character of Saul Goodman is the cilantro.
Right.
To build a show around that kind of lawyer guy, it doesn't seem...
It's like doing a Parks and Rec spinoff about Perd Hapley.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
But I really, really dig this show. There is something... What you forget is how funny Breaking Bad was. Breaking Bad was effortlessly funny. Mm-hmm. Amid all the darkness, it was just...
It sure was.
The sensibility was a humorous one, even amid all this horrible violence. And here, you get some of that same thing. And the humor comes, like it does in a lot of Elmore Leonard novels, from just how dumb these criminals are. Mm-hmm. How stupid they are. And so it feels a little bit like Justified, which also plays, because that's actually based on an Elmore Leonard short story. So that's mm-hmm. playing in that same sandbox. There's a montage, again, with the montages. The montage in the second episode where we see him doing his job at the public defender's office or you know, just defending a string of criminals. And we mm-hmm. see how great he is at it. Uh-huh. And B, there's a moment where he's talking, he's defending somebody, and we just get a clip of him saying, "To make cookies."
Yeah.
That's the engine of this show. And mm-hmm. it's like his superhero origin story, where he discovers how great he is at convincing yeah. people, mm-hmm. how he has a mouth on him, as somebody yeah. tells him.
I am interested that Stephen had not seen Breaking Bad, because I did wonder a little bit, could you be dropped into this world and not, because I had such a great, I know I never thought I would say this, but I was so happy to see Albuquerque again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like there was so, you know, the showrunners have such a wonderful way of creating that world, and I felt relieved to be back in it, and I don't know how I would have felt had I not spent so much time with the Breaking Bad characters, and those moments of like seeing Jonathan Banks, who I just always want to see Jonathan Banks, so that made me
Mike Ehrmantraut.
Right. I will say, I've only seen the first two episodes, and I did feel in the first episode that a little bit the exposition was showing a little bit, but I loved the scaffolding that they were building, because mm-hmm. it is so different. And then just that the fact of, you know, how beautifully it shot, you know, looking from inside the mailbox when he's putting the cell phone and the keys in. So I think it looks as beautiful as Breaking Bad, and I think obviously this backstory with the brother and the law firm is complicated and interesting and stands on its own.
Well, in a way, they've set up a lot of parallels between, mm-hmm. well, Jimmy McGill, as he's mm-hmm. known at this stage of his career, and Walter White, where mm-hmm. these are both desperate people who are desperately trying to survive in a world that is typically not built to suit them. Mm-hmm. And so everything is about trying to crawl out of the jam he's in. And of course, in the processes of doing that, digging himself deeper and deeper into something that he's, you know, that he has to become equipped to handle.
Yeah. And I think the difference between those characters, the key difference as this show sets itself up, is that Walter White was someone who, once he got a taste of this world of kind of danger and being, quote unquote, in the game, was sort of fascinated by it. And that was really his downfall in a lot of ways, was that he was instantly infatuated with mm-hmm. this power struggle that he quickly found himself involved in, and with maneuvering around these very dangerous guys. Jimmy McGill wants nothing to do with this and mm-hmm. only wants to be kind of a light scam artist slash really good criminal defense attorney. And Barry mentioned Albuquerque and mentioned the look of the show. Mm-hmm. Breaking Bad was an impeccably done show visually. And people talk a lot about television as a writer's medium. I think it often is perceived as a writer's medium. But Breaking Bad was a show that was
surely visual,
always directed with just an enormous amount of style. And they brought these people in to direct like Rian Johnson directed on Breaking Bad, and the second episode of Better Call Saul, which takes place largely, a big chunk of it takes place out in the desert, was directed by Michelle MacLaren, who is about to do Wonder Woman.
Right.
Her feel for those out in the desert confrontations, the minute I saw those guys out in the desert, I was so happy
right.
to see that again because it's so gorgeous. And, you know, I was worried about this show, too. Glenn kind of talked about this. And I feel like when you do when you wrap up a world, I'm ready to go to a different one. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily into going back and reopening it. But I think that what happened for me was the tone of the show is different enough
right.
because it is centered around this protagonist who is legitimately much more reluctant than Walter White. And because it is more comedic, it does not open as Breaking Bad did with a ton of blood and gore and kind of explosive violence. I kind of tucked into it and I thought, I do want to watch this as a matter of fact.
I want this cilantro.
I definitely do want to watch
this.
Because I had the same concern and I think it's critical that those protagonists are different and that the tone is different. And it also is different in the sense that one of the whole things of Breaking Bad was what's going to happen to Walter White.
Right.
The whole will Walter White survive this show was a huge thing that went around and around and around. And I kind of love the fact that whatever people want to make of this show, you know where Jimmy
right.
McGill is going to wind up.
Yep.
Not just that he's going to
yeah.
wind up turning into Saul Goodman and representing very, very right. bad people, but you know what's going to happen to him at the end of Breaking Bad. Like,
right.
you know what the future is. Mm-hmm. And so you don't get so tied up in that. It is easier for people to concentrate on journey, as
yeah.
they say.
Mm-hmm. One of the ways you can tell prestige television, whatever the hell that means, is when a scene begins, do you know what is going to happen in it? That scene in the desert was absolutely riveting because you had no idea
right.
whether or not Saul was going to do something. And then if he does, what the other guy's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's that magical feeling of not knowing what's going to happen.
And it wasn't linear. It kept shifting.
Yeah. It kept shifting in a way that life does. Things like that happen, but never on television. Yeah.
I really, really like it. I'll be really interested to see what they do with it next. Well, before we go to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy this week, we're going to take a very quick break. We'll be right back with all of our happy choices for the week. So stick around.
Blue Apron is a new service that delivers all the ingredients you need to make incredible meals at home. Ingredients are perfectly portioned and come with an easy-to-follow recipe card so you can create a delicious meal in 35 minutes or less. You'll cook meals like Thai chicken meatballs with red coconut curry and bok choy, or macadamia-crusted cod with black rice and golden beet salad. Discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/NPR to get your first two meals free.
Welcome back. This brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
We are at a point in the Austin 100 preparation process that I like to call despair. I have very, very, very little to add to anything
yeah.
in my life. By the time that you download this episode of the show, the soonest you're going to download it is Friday, right? Come Tuesday, it will be available for streaming and download. So if you think of each song as being worth a dollar, we are essentially giving you 100 damn dollars.
Yeah.
Now, what will be making me happy post-despair,
yeah.
and hopefully around the time this podcast drops, probably a little after, is that I will be done with the Austin 100 and ready to, like, go fly, little bird, to extend my hands and see it flap away, at which point I beg of all of you people that you'll tell your friends.
Mm-hmm.
You'll spread the word far and wide and make it a huge hit. In addition to it being completely and fully downloadable, the NPR visuals team, which is the most amazing bunch of professionals I have been around, they just the other day, they just took a wheelbarrow to collect a bunch of awards.
Yes, they did.
Including one for the Songs We Love app, which we've discussed on the show. The visuals team used that Songs We Love app as a jumping off point to create this spectacular visual experience for if you want to stream the Austin 100 on your computer or tablet or phone. I say I'm just about done talking about it. I'm not. I'm not just about done talking about it. I'm about to reach the point where all I'm going to do is talk about it because I'm done and I want to share it with you lovely people, and your enjoyment of it will be my oxygen.
Oh, Thompson. Thank you, buddy. Oh. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Ruthless efficiency is making me happy in the form of a film called John Wick, Keanu Reeves film. Here's the premise. He's an ex-assassin in a swanky ultra-modern house. The wife dies. She leaves him a little puppy dog. Some bad people come, kill the dog. He goes out for revenge. Did I spoil half the movie? No, I spoiled like 6 minutes of the first... Pretty much the first act is 6 to 10 minutes long, and it's still, because of what's coming, it still feels flabby. Feels like you could just, probably, that's a lot of shots of the dog. And then, you know, he proceeds to go on this incredible rampage. It is so light on its feet. It knows exactly what it is. It is bloody as hell. But every actor who turns up is an actor you want to see in a movie like this. And so the reaction you keep having as the as somebody kind of turns around in a chair or something, you're like, hey, it's that guy. Over and over and over again. He's found this weird little slot that he's in. And it's not a great movie. Let's be clear. But man, is it fun! And it creates this little world in 90 minutes. It's a movie that's 90 minutes long.
Yeah.
Yay! Remember that? John Wick. Check it out. It's a lot of fun. Ruthless efficiency.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I'm very happy to tell you that what's making us happy is, or me, actually us, when I say, because I have now, many people I know subscribe to this newsletter. This is the Two Bossy Dames newsletter. One of the dames is a friend of the show, Margaret Willison.
Yeah. Aww.
Everybody make an awe.
She's gone from listener to guest to topic.
Right. To like slumber party
soon,
wish list. Like
soon
I just
she will be hosting.
Yeah, I can't totally.
I for one welcome our new overlord.
Yeah,
I do
true.
Too.
Right,
but
so one of them is Margaret.
One of them is Margaret and the other is Sophie Brookover. And they have reinvented for me. This is the only newsletter, literally the only newsletter that I pay attention to. And everything in it is good, well written, a thing I want to listen to. Like suddenly I was like, how come I can't take pictures of my kids anymore? And it's like, oh, because of all the podcasts that I got from Two Bossy Dames. Uh-huh. Like they're great at curating exactly what I want. And doing it in a way that is fun and exciting. I really, really look forward to it.
We'll give you a link.
But I tend to get it on Friday, and it's like, you know, it's like getting a hot toddy. A really strong hot toddy.
That's true.
So, I mean, yeah. And those dames are terrific. I also want to just shout out to the fact that the backdrop of their paper is Lauren Bacall doing that sexy, sexy dance, which every time I see it pop up, I'm like, oh, then I have to do the Lauren Bacall sexy, sexy dance, which probably isn't that sexy, but it gives a gal a feeling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So,
all right.
Anyway, well, recommended highly.
Yep. Two bossy dames. Thank you very much, Barry Hardiman. I got two things this week. First of all, I have become a person who has a Tumblr where I put all of the stuff that I write about cooking, because now I'm that person, and it's the law. And if you feel like you want to read it, it's called theoppositeofless.tumblr.com is where you would find it. It's where I write about making bread and other things occasionally.
Speaking as a man who received a loaf of bread on his doorstep the other day,
that's true.
I will say I approve of this.
That is true. So that's the first thing. The other thing is my real thing making me happy this week, and that is the great British Bake Off. Now, in the United States, this is known as the Great British Baking Show in its run on PBS, which I suspect is because Pillsbury owns the words Bake Off in the United States. Mm-hmm. I'm not positive. I think that might be why. It is actually in its fifth season, which is the first one PBS has run in the United States. It is a show in which I think it's 10 British people who bake get together. And every week, there's three challenges. Every week, there is first a signature bake, which will be, you know, variations on a theme, like you got to make cookies. and then they got to make cookies. Then they have the technical bake, which is where everyone has to make exactly the same thing from the same recipe. They can see how good you are at it because they see how, you know, everybody's stuff comes out differently. And then the third one is the showstopper, where it'll be you have to make some big crazy ass cake or something like that. The Great British Baking Show, as they call it here, is one of the most delightful, sweet, encouraging, warm-hearted things you are ever going to watch on television. Stephen and I are both suckers for competitive reality shows where everyone is nice and everyone is supportive and there are no jerks. They don't have jerks on the British Baking Show. They have two really nice women who are the hosts. They have two really cool judges, one of whom is an older, very proper British lady, and one of whom is kind of like a dude who would be like a celebrity chef. Mm-hmm. They find the perfect balance of, like, they will tell you, this did not turn out. Because the thing with baking is a lot of times it either turns out or it doesn't. So sometimes you got to go present to them a thing that completely fell apart. Like literally it didn't set. It came out of the mold as goo. And they will say, clearly this didn't work. And it might be that you'll be eliminated. But they will taste it. And they will potentially say, you had the flavors right. Mm-hmm. There's no eviscerating. There's no backbiting. Nobody says anything nasty about each other ever. As far as I can tell. Although there was apparently some big scandal at the beginning of this season, which I haven't seen yet. But in the old ones that I'm watching, nobody even gets angry. They get frustrated. Mm-hmm. Nobody even gets angry. It is the sweetest, bestest thing. I am totally in love with it. And there's a ton of it. I encourage you to find this show if you can. Seek it out. It's really wonderful. The Great British Bake Off, as they call it there, baking show, as they call it here. It's running on PBS. It's so good. It's so good. It's really wonderful, and it's been really perking me up this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can follow Barry at B. Hardiman. That's H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. You can also follow the show at NPRPCHH. But on the topic of Mike Katziff, Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, your guide to what's good in pop culture. Every week, Jesse Thorne interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. We like Bullseye. Find Bullseye now at iTunes under Podcasts.